So I wonder what I can say that would be useful for this evening. Language is the darndest thing, because we all need it and use it, and yet the very nature of language is you can't say everything in one word. And always, what we mean by the term sometimes gets confusing. Well, so much of it is really based upon the direct experience, and we try to keep our language soft enough and flexible enough to meet the direct experience. The direct experience that we all have, which is always useful with meditating, not meditating, speaking, working, whatever we're doing, is we're being affected and we're responding. We're affected and responding. And this affecting, responding, this is what's meant by mind. In the most total sense. Doesn't mean thinking, though thinking's part of it. Doesn't mean your emotions, there are emotions that are part of it. Doesn't mean your bodily reactions and senses, that's part of it. But around all this stuff, physical, visual, emotional, conceptual, real, imagined, crazy, wonderful, past, future, present, whatever it is, there's a sense of something's affecting, something's coming in there and getting me going or interesting or stirring, and there's a response to that. Response may be to follow it, to push it away, to think about it, to get really focused on it, or to drop it. There's always effect and response, effect and response, effect and response. And of course this is not a thing, is it? So, you know, when we even were to use a word like mind, then we tend to assume it's some kind of fixed entity. Somebody's asking me today, what's the difference with the mind in the brain? You know, if you lose what a brain is, brain is something that resembles custard or tofu. Sometimes it's true that your mind does feel like custard or tofu. But when you cut one of these things open, you don't find any mind in it. It's like having a TV set. You switch on the TV and you see the football game. What the hell, those little guys got so small and crammed themselves inside the box. Where do they go when you switch it off? You cut the box open, you don't see any little men sitting around in there. Kicking balls around or playing anything. So it's best to just put that one aside. Where is it? Because right now it's happening. That's what you can know. Right now it's happening. It's always happening. If you like, there are kind of central things, rather like like a current in a river. There are certain vortexes and eddies and turbulences that become very dynamic. You know, and the stuff that's just lazing around. So all of us have to experience this, things that are peripheral, and every now and then one of those peripheral things swings right into the centre and becomes big topic. Some topics seem to stay there, vortexing around for ages, so much so they seem to be permanent and exactly what I am. Fixed, permanent, full of energy, and that's what I am. Yeah. So, but what we can recognize in meditation is the things you do pay attention to through this process of being affected and responding, they're all energetic. Notice how much energy aversion has in it, or jealousy, or worry, or joy, or love, good, bad, indifferent, silly, wonderful, intelligent, it's always got energy in it. And the more energy it has, the more it forms the center of your mind. But even though it's forming there, it's still, even though it's energetic, it has the same permanence as a vortex. You know, vortex may keep forming in the center of that stream for a long while if the rocks are in the right place. And if you move the rocks, where did it go? Did you get into the stream and cut it out? No. Did you solve it and resolve it? No, you just moved the rocks and suddenly, no, it wasn't there anymore. So a lot of our practice is a twofold nature. One is to just kind of clear away some of the debris and the surplus input that we don't need to be making at this particular time. Stuff you don't need to keep putting into the center, so that you can really understand the nature of a center, what concerns, what interests, what motivates, what excites, what irritates, you know, the feeling of it, the feeling of being in there, moved, got at, impelled. Sometimes something's coming up, you really feel you've got to do something about, you've got to get on with. Something you really want to do. You can't bear to live another moment without it. And the moment passes by. And you're still here. Yeah. And sometimes it's like that, isn't it? You know, I mean, experiences in life or in meditation where you think, I can't stand this, another moment. And then you do. And it still goes on saying, I can't stand this, another moment. And then you do. Because in the moment you're watching yourself not being able to stand it, you're standing it. But that energy comes out with the same voice, the same sound. I can't stand it, I don't want this, it shouldn't be this way, I don't stand it. Till eventually you start to learn, oh, that's part of the nature of that energy. That's what makes it so central. I can't stand it. I've got to have it. Yeah, the big ones, I've got to have it. They come, they've got so much juice in them, they take over the center. You've got to have whatever it is, the new gizmo, the new car, the new clothes, or something, you know, more lofty, fourth jhana, emptiness, bliss, nirvana, give me that thing. Yeah. And in that tightness of that vortex, what we keep expecting and looking for is a thing. Because that's the way vortexes are. They look kind of solid and they look like things. Actually, they're energies, compelling, compulsive energies. And we look for a compelling, compulsing thing to fill that place and make it better, gratified, pleasant, enjoyable. And there isn't one, because it's like you know, what you experience as a big hole, as something that's lacking, is not actually you try and put something in it to fill it up. Find the right thing there to fill it up, that hole, the empty place, that gnawing, nervous, need one place. Yeah. And you try this, you try trying a motorbike, no. Try a movie, no. Try, don't quite do it. Try this, that, an idea, an ideology, religion, not quite. There's something quite there with it. Because the main problem is that it's not really a thing that you need. And what is the problem is not an absence of something, it's the presence of something. And what needs to be done is release, release, release. Release the tangle, release the energy. Doesn't mean get rid of the energy, but release it from that tight, constricted, pressing, pushing place. That's the vortex. You know? No matter what you put inside that vortex, it won't stop it being a vortex. Yeah. So whatever we conceive of, nirvana, jhanas, vipassana, you get one of these ideas or theories as an idea and you try and put it in there, it doesn't stop it. And so it's really, the process is one of feeling some of that stuff and releasing it, releasing it, releasing it. And this is what, you know, this is what the Buddha was teaching. And the process of simplifying, clarifying, which we could call simplicity or focus or renunciation or calming, they're all processes that try to simplify the amount of stuff that's swinging around so you can focus as this central feature of experience, which is this what occupies, what grabs the center. It takes that in. And how that can be released. This is very deep because wherever this sense of the center forms becomes the sense of being really affected and coming up with a lot of responses, strong effects, strong responses, happy effects, happy responses, happier effects, greedy responses, happy effects, loving responses, that's who I am. That's who I am. You know, when you look at it, you try to get into it, well, you can see, you know, you've got some hair, you've got some feet, you've got some this, you've got, but that's not where you are, because you can lose all these. When you come down to it, what you really, if you're going to try, if you say what you really are as a direct experience, it's a sense of being affected and responding. Yeah. Something's bothering me. Something's interesting me. Yeah. And I want to do that about it. Or I, yeah. That's the felt experience of self, and that's the center. And we say, now I want to get liberated. I want to get peaceful. I want to get enlightened and happy and wise and cared for and secure about the future and, it's a lot in there already, isn't it? And I don't actually want to have to give up anything if I don't have to. But the very setup, you see, of the I am experience is already the vortex, it's already the knot. Yeah? It's already that sense of, you know, being at that point of affecting, being affected and responding. Now it's a natural point, and in fact it's necessary for our lives to have this experience, to orient, to navigate, to negotiate our way through lives. We've got to have this experience. You've got to be clear about it, so that that experience really works well, because it hasn't got a lot of its own agendas. It hasn't got a lot of its own confusions mixed up in it. It's something that really operates for your welfare, rather than is continually hashing over things that happened 10 years ago, things that might be and should be, way other people are, way they aren't, and what I am and what I'm not, what I should be, why I'm this way, and how I could be that way, and who I am, whether I exist or not, you know, all this kind of clutter of the means of our ability to be affected and responding truly, fully, in the only place that we really exist directly, which is the present, can be free of these accumulations, free of these pasts, free of the future, free of my opinions about myself, free of my doubts about myself, just the free ability to be affected in responding. This means you've got to take the self out of the center. So that this centrality, being affected, being responding, can be free from all kinds of, we might crudely say, egotistical stuff. Self-doubt, self-consciousness, these sorts of things that we all experience. So the process is really one of a purification, and then the beginning to realize we can also just release that center, so it becomes something that's much more undefinable. And this is the Buddha called Nibbana. You don't get it, you just release into it, you unfold into it, you come out of that tension into it. And it's a place of deep peace, because it's not in that affect respond manner. Now, sometimes the process of practice, which you probably, you know, all of you are familiar with in many ways, structures I'm sure you've been given. So I'll just say it another way. That's because sometimes you say it another way, it freshens things up, or it hits another aspect. And I'd like to say three fundamental processes you undertake. One is that everybody would agree upon, I think, no matter what you're doing, you pay attention. This doesn't happen without being attentive, without coming into the present with something and really, you know, getting with that, paying attention, finding the center, you might say. Finding really how you kind of clear away the peripheral or the unnecessary pay attention. And the very act of paying attention has a centering effect. Because generally when you pay attention, you pay attention to a particular point, thing, item, theme, attitude. It forms a center. Yeah. And the center now is one we've chosen. It's not just continually taking form around any old thing that comes along, or upon memories, or upon wishes, or upon grudges, or upon problems. You're deliberately forming center so you can understand the nature of it. Paying attention. You can do this with breathing in and out, you can do it with, you know, whatever systems, themes you do, but one thing about them is they're all definable. So it gives you a certain thing to focus on. And as you do that, whatever your meditation theme is, your practice is, you start to learn about how to pay attention, how to sustain it, how to find a way to pay attention so that you're not too scrunched up and tight and pushy about it, you're not drifting and lackadaisical about it. And just learning how to pay attention, of course, is an enormous asset in our lives. You know what it takes to pay attention to something. It means you've really got to put other things aside, doesn't it? And what you pay attention to is going to affect, because you're putting it right there in the center of your affective experience. When you consider this, you realize, you know, what do you pay attention to in your day? You realize what you pay attention to is going to have an effect on you, and it's going to evoke certain responses. So let's do a bit of editing, you know, on what we attend to. If you notice, actually, the conventional mindset is one that is not tends to scatter. It's like a squirrel. It scatters around because it's got to be on the lookout for food, for predators, possible mates, security places, places to bury nuts, and our minds are pretty much the same as that. They're scatter systems. They're on the rove, they're hunting. So when you want to pay attention, you've got to feel, hey, there's no prey here. And I've got enough food, and I don't need to shin up a tree, I can sit. So what it takes to pay attention is part of that learning practice. And one of the things that we obviously, perhaps not obviously, but really start to cultivate is how the most fundamental form of security is good friends, externally, and also contentment with ourselves, a sense of morality. So we haven't got things continually gnawing at us, having to bury things, but we feel clean and clear in ourselves. So you see, it's very wide, because you realize when you're paying attention, you're gathering a center, but the center forms within a whole wide field of life, doesn't it? You know, the mind is holistic. It's not like blip, 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 one point, is it? The mind is holistic. In other words, you're receiving input from all kinds of channels. So when you're driving a car, you don't have to pull the car up before to find out whether you feel hungry or not. You know, you could be driving the car and there's this peripheral feeling a bit hungry or need to take a pee or something. You don't have to stop the car to find out whether you need to take a pee. It's not like just there's one blip at a time. There's a whole kind of peripheral field that's kind of wavering, and some of it's becoming more and more central. Hey, I really need to take a pee. It's really getting very, very important. It gradually nudges its way into the center, doesn't it? Yeah. Suddenly you don't need to worry about what your aunt's doing because it's getting really pressurized. So it takes over the center. So, you realize the mind is actually holistic, so we've always got to keep aware of the broad field of our lives, because any one of those items in that field can swing into the center. You know, things we did 5 years ago can suddenly move right in, can't they? Nothing is really gone, nothing is really external to the mind. We're in a field of what's called karma. So we realize, if you want to really have attention that's easy and clear, you want to stop all kinds of stuff just drifting in there or getting pulled into that center point. So you start to see the need for clarity and simplicity and goodness in your lives. Not from some kind of moralizing position, but from, what it takes to feel good with yourself. Paying attention. And then how you pay attention. The qualities of what brings attention skillfully onto something. Is it force? Is it pressure? Patience, generally. Repeatedness. Patience, repeatedness, kindness. All the time in the world. Yeah, that kind of quality, and yet having a theme. So we start to realize how a lot of our attention experiences can be grabbed, or grabbed by something, or grabbing something. And this gives your whole mindset a very jerky energy to it. So we start to pay attention to this, gently forming it, time after time after time, forming it. And you begin to get the sense of, hey, this is what it's like to be patient, or to be gentle, or to be persistent, or to have clear intentions. And just so the very act of paying attention as a theme becomes an education that affects a lot of the ways we act, because we're always paying attention to something or another. What does it take? So you find a way to sustain a center, and it's how that becomes possible. And that's the first part of a process. You do this when you do retreats, or raise children. You've got a focal point. Something has to be left aside. And this is a bit that sometimes people don't like the sound of. less options. Mostly the theme of the day is more options. 45 options. Different colours, different shapes, different forms. So actually then when we want to pay attention, we realise, oh, that's complicated, it's too much. I'd soon have it simple. And then you realize from the benefit that comes from clarity and composure, actually, this is where it feels best, not because it's this color or shape or taste, because I feel comfortable with this. That's how it feels best. So a lot can be learned from paying attention. The second process is kind of what I sometimes call softening and widening. You know how the particularly, you know, our cerebral functions or our emotional functions sometimes get very fixed on what they attend to. It becomes pretty compulsive, becomes pretty, this is right, this is good, this is the right system, this is the right way to be, this is the right attitude, I am right. And funnily enough, everybody's right. Of course they're right, otherwise they wouldn't be doing it. Nobody thinks I'm doing the wrong thing. Or if they do, they think, last I'm right, I've discovered what's right because that was wrong. Everybody's right, and yet there's a lot of them, aren't there? Particularly when we get into arguments, then what felt, yeah, that feels right to me, becomes really right. Becomes absolutely right. The tension builds up, the energy builds up, because what I've put in the center becomes myself, becomes where I am, becomes my standpoint, becomes my identity, becomes my view, becomes what I really believe in, and it becomes challenged by people who are saying it's another way, or you got it wrong, or it should be another way. Who do you think you are? I got it right. Before you only felt it was kind of right. When somebody challenges, it becomes really right. I was saying of this fond memory I have of this Chinese master, Master Hua, who had had a kind of interfaith meeting in his monastery. He was a Chan master. So he had this interfaith meeting, invited all kinds, every religion, every stripe, every form, every domination who wanted to come could come. So you got the Methodists and the Baptists and the Catholics and the Orthodox, so you got the Jews and the Muslims and the Shiites and the Sunnis, and you got the Theravadins and the nondescripts and the undefineds and the Zens and the New Age and the Aquarians and whatever, you know, and the people who kind of just wanted to hang out and grab it all. He says, so everybody gets up and he says, everybody give a little talk on your religion, on your theme. So some gets up and everybody gets up and says, well, I respect all religions. We respect all religions. You know, we want to be friends in harmony with all religions. And the next person gets up and says, we in our religion, we are very broad, we accept everyone else, and so forth. You know, so they have kind of high-minded aspirations and talks about harmony, and we all need to get together and form harmony together so that we can find a sense of harmoniously walking together. So at the end of it, the Master Hua gets up and says, okay, we've listened to all these talks, everybody, really interesting talks, now we've got to decide who's got the best religion. Let's get down to it, whose is the best? So go, ooh. And he stood up and he pointed his finger and says, well, yours is the best, otherwise you wouldn't be following it, would you? Everybody's right. And that helps you to get a sense of, yeah, I'm right, but what does right mean? You know, does right mean conflict? Does right mean conceit? Does right mean defense? Is that what it means? Yeah. And what have we put into that term? Democracy, justice, freedom, and the amount of killing and violence that goes on under those banners. God, love, truth, the right, and the amount of arguing, fighting, killing goes on under for the name of the right. This may hurt a bit for you, but it will be good for you in the end because this is right. Yeah. And generally, you know, some of this is not hypocritical. People really believe that, feel that, and sincerely feel that. So this is the nature of the right. The nature of what we feel is good and right and true. It has that quality to it. So when we soften, we say, this is kind of rightish. Or we say something like, this is appropriate, or this is kind of working for me right now. This is what I feel clear about at this time. You know? I'm interested in what works for you. You know? Because then maybe we might start to get beyond the terminologies and attitudes, get down to some really interesting thing that we can't quite define, of where we start to feel whole, easy, clear, and what really to me occurs at that place most obviously is the relational sense on one level. It's actually that as the Buddha himself, when confronted by a wanderer who's asking what his opinions were, what's your bit, what's your shtick? And he said, my thing is I don't find any conflict with anyone in the world. And the guy goes, yeah, right. he stumps off, you know. So it's a sort of sense of how we relate, really, to ourselves, to our bodies, to our hearts, to other people. When that feels right. Yeah? And then it's not really an idea right, is it? It's not a thing right. It's a sense of there can be that ability to receive and share. You know, our effect and response can soften and widen. You know? And when I mean soften, I mean instead of it being so encased, like this is this and this is that, just say, what is, how is that? Softer. You're still maintaining that sense of the what's clear or what, where you're focusing, and yet there's that kind of quality of not being in that deeply embedded that you can't check it out, and softening and widening. You know? Widening means there's room for others, there's room for other things. And there's a breadth. And the mind starts to feel that center where we felt clear and attentive starts to open and be larger. And instead of us finding a place in the world has a place in us. We get bigger. We soften and widen to include it all. And including it all is what I call the third part of Dhamma practice. First of all, you can't, you know, if you take it the other way round, it goes wrong. If you try to include it all before you have a center, you just get overwhelmed. You know, so the idea of just being completely open to everything as a starting point isn't really going to be that useful. I mean, I started out when I had a spiritual inclination, an inclination in finding truth, when I was really pretty young, actually, because other things didn't make sense to me. I just couldn't figure out what this life, being alive, was about. You know, seeing my dad work himself to death every day, you know, and getting nowhere apart from staying where he was. Is this it? That's what I'm going to be doing? Sheesh. Is there anything else? So I really started to look around, you know, and that maybe was necessary, but then, you know, including it all before I really had a sense of balance in myself. So I'd read all these books, you know, smoke a load of dope, you know, whatever, throw it in, try this, try that, because, so I certainly included a lot of things, got pretty broad, so broad I was kind of didn't have any edges anymore, and couldn't find any sense of real, what's the thing you do? What's the one bit? Where's the one bit? So for me, the first real starting point was to say, well, just put God, the cosmos, the universe, all to one side for a moment. Just see if you can spend 5 minutes breathing in and breathing out, you know. And realizing I couldn't. My first meditation was about, I went to a meditation class and said, you know, sit down and watch, just focus on your breathing, breathing in and breathing out for 15 minutes. I couldn't do it 15 minutes. I couldn't do it for a minute. It was boom. Suddenly this whole realm of craziness opened up. And it was great, really, because I didn't realize how crazy it was until I started trying to find my breathing. Maybe that doesn't sound like such a great enlightening revelation, but for me, it was the real putting your foot on the spiritual path, because then two things aroused. First of all, the sense of, wow, this is really a mess. you better sort something out. And also, at the same time, this feeling of, hey, you can watch this. Something in you is obviously clear enough to notice the rest of it. That's interesting, isn't it? There's a watcher, and there's this kind of heaving stuff of the mind. And just that alone, and maybe a little bit of inspiration from seeing other people practicing, was the main fulcrum of my practice in the early years. Just that I can watch this stuff. I don't actually have to engage in it, judge it, push it away, discover anything. I can find this really interesting, center, paying attention, finding a center. And just by putting more energy and value into the ability to watch, it started to draw energy out of the craziness. So the craziness started, the colours started to fade a little. And if you've been doing psychedelics for, there's a lot of colour there. There's a lot of movement there, so it took a while for that to just start to fade. I spent the first 18 months like a non-stop rock concert in my head. Again and again and again. It's like all this stuff that I'd absorbed. So about the only thing I could do was at least attempt to be breathing in and breathing out, walking up and down, staying at one point. And even though I couldn't find the one physical point, I could at least find this sense of watching, witnessing, and eventually making less of a big deal about what was going on in my heart and mind. And just that alone starts to shift energy, because the energy gathers where your center is. And your center is in paying attention, in awareness, rather than the object. So it starts to kind of calm down. Despite all my efforts to meditate, it calmed down. Because the efforts to meditate were as frantic as the craziness. So the first years, so I found the best way was actually to not meditate, and not meditate, but just to witness stuff going on. And try to get to this point. Just keep the intention. The intention was there. But then over the time, then you start to feel a little bit, got some clarity and calm and steadiness, and you start to get a little bit like, hey, I am somebody, I've got something, got it. And then, she hasn't got it. How much has he got? I bet he's got a lot. She looks as if she's about to get it. And you start, hey, what's going on here? And how long can I sit? Can I sit longer than the other people? Can I sit more steadily than the other? Can I even sit more upright than the other people? So you start kind of like meditation competitions. Can I remain unmoved more than other people? Gee, this is getting a bit painful too, isn't it? So all this sense of that paying attention also has to be purified, and this sense of beginning to soften. And for me, the obvious quality of softening is quality of metta, kindness, just mutuality to others as to myself, to others as to myself. So softening and widening. So the focus isn't just, you know, what appears to be my mind, but what is in awareness, and that whatever is in awareness, may that also be well, may that be peaceful, may that be allowed to be how it is. Softening, widening. And realizing over time that, particularly when these are other people, it's naturally more clearer, you know. Just to wish other people well, to be with other people's stress, and just be a presence and calm and okay with that, not keep coming up with you should be this, you should be that. So myself, a lot of that process of softening, widening came around through being with other people. Realizing the kind of things I would do to myself, I would never do to another person. You know, the kind of forcefulness that I'd apply to my own mind, I would never do to that somebody else. You know. And how helpful that is, that relational sense. To others as to myself. And you begin to see the way that I would feel some sympathy and some compassion for somebody else's struggles, or some patience with other people, I began to find that coming back to the way I handle my own stuff. So truly a blessing, the relational field. Softening, widening. Just considering where we get hard, where we get pinched, where we get tight. Is it possible to just, you know, feel the stress in that and start to, you know, how much do you really need of this? How much do you really need to be right? How much you need to be defined as this or that? How much you need to take a stand? And then when you start to feel the benefits of that, you know, the mind becoming more buoyant, more abundant, richer, gentler, more skillful, then you include it all, which is the third thing, include it all. And that's, so including it all means, you know, not trying to push away that uncomfortable piece, but, or fix it or change it, but just include that uncomfortable piece in your awareness. Yeah. Include that in there. A lot of meditation, you know, we are coming up against particular problems, difficulties, physical difficulties, difficulties in our relationships with other people, difficulties about our jobs, difficulties about unresolved things happening in the world and how we're living, and we want it to be enough, we try to fix it, and we feel disappointed by it. If only it wasn't here, I could get some clarity and some peace and get on with it. You know, if I could just kind of find a way to sort of sort that out. As far as I've recognized over 35 years of practice, once you've sorted one out, the next one pops up. When do you ever get to the end of this? When's it ever going to end? When are people really going to start to behave themselves? When is it going to end? When is my mind ever going to quieten down? You know, there's an interesting thing that Ajahn Chah said. He said, you know, when you get to that feeling, when's it going to stop? When's it going to end? The only thing that has to end is that thought, when's it going to end? That's the problem. That's the indignation. That's the frustration. That's the impatience. That's the burden. Yeah? So it's kind of, you know, this is not a technique, is it? It's like a process of maturing, where how we can accommodate, how we can be with, how we can bring these qualities into a widening field. A lot of the time, you know, we ask questions which come out as quite, you know, as head questions. what can I do about my daughter hanging out with this guy I don't like? She's never going to do any good like that. She's going to get herself into a bad way. What can I do? How can I sort her out? How can I make her come to her senses? You know, get away from this guy I don't really like. You know, what's the way to do it? Tell me the way to do it. How can I fix this? It's a head question, isn't it? What's the bit? And maybe the problem is we ask a question from the wrong place, and we look for an answer in the wrong place, because the question is really not a head question. The question is really, I am worried. That's not a question, it's a statement. I am worried. I have concern. It's a question, it's a compassion issue. It's a love issue. It's a concern issue. And, you know, you can't have a head answer to a heart topic. When you come to that, I am worried, I am concerned, it made me think, well, perhaps you should just say, I love you and I'm worried. Help me. Maybe that would be the Maybe that would be the answer. Just actually to be coming from the place where the question really starts. And finding response from directly addressing what really is affecting. The mind is holistic, it's both in our heads, well, it's conceptual, it's emotional, it's also embodied. We feel all kinds of tensions in our bodies, we feel all kinds of pressures and wobbles and flushes and tingles and spasms going on in our bodies. Some of these, when you recognize it's like that, and you start to see it like that, sometimes why we sit is because really we have all kinds of questions and issues and things we need to settle ourselves. The answer is, I think you just need to sit down. Breathe in and breathe out. It's a body answer. You start with the body energy. And then from there, you may feel that gradually as you settle, there's greater clarity to see really what the topic is, and you may find a heart issue answer to it. Then we've got to realize that we have a holistic awareness, and you use all and any aspect of that in practice, include it all. Don't just think your thoughts, also tune in to the emotion, the heart quality behind it, and tune in to the bodily sense of that, the energy of it, the pressure of it, the heat of it, the tension of it, the bubble of it. You get the whole bit, then you start to sense which is the bit which is really the nub of it. And you go, and I can't give an answer to that, but this is what makes it so interesting, is the sense of exploring, including the wholeness of the mind to meet topics and issues that are actually whole topics. And maybe, you know, the final whole topic that we have to, all of us have to meet sooner or later, we can, you know, spend our time doing many other things, but the final topic all of us have to meet is, who is this? Who is this that's born and dying? Who is this that comes and goes? Who is this who's happy and sad? Who is this who's excited and interested and talented and gifted and confused? Who is this? Who is this center? And this is where, of course, there's no answer to that. But there's a release from that through really holding or attending to widening and softening, including all aspects of what this self-experience starts to manifest as, and recognizing as you include it, well, that one's passing. Well, that one seems to have dropped away. Well, that one's changing. Oh, even the interest in finding an answer seems to be drifting off. And we're left in an openness that we can't ever know or name. The Buddha said, but the Buddha did say, he couldn't name it, but he said, this is the best. This is the peaceful, this is the sublime. The resting from all of these formative energies, the sankharas. The elimination of all these past agendas and standpoints. This is the sublime, this is nibbana. For this we have to pay attention, soften and widen, include it all. Including all means, you know, another way of putting it is all the karma. Coming to terms with meeting all the karma that we have, all the urges and stuff that gets us going. It's a lifetime work, lifetime practice, but there's nothing else to do. Which makes it simple, isn't it? And then whether you're sitting, meditating, or who you're with, it's all part of working on karma. This is the big one, the big picture. Once you get that in mind, you have no doubt about practice. The practice that can work on all levels is the practice you can trust. So offer this for your reflection. Okay, so I'd like to have a few moments to pause, and then if you have any things you'd like to put my way in terms of questions or comments, I'm happy to spend time with you. Whirring, 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 whirring. I always hear the wheels turning, huh? Must be something in there. Yes.
About the watcher.
About what?
You talked about the watcher.
The watcher, oh yeah.
The watcher. I wonder if there are times when you're not aware, when one is not aware of the watcher.
Oh yeah.
When one is so averse to whatever.
Oh yeah.
What should be said about that?
It's bad news. Well, yeah, yeah, okay, I think I get a sort of subtler sense of what you're referring to. Because it, you know, I say words are tricky, and there's different senses of awareness. So, you know, sometimes when we're in flow experiences, there can be a very fine sense of awareness that's actually much more almost energetically based rather than conceptually based. That is, you know, like if you're doing, I don't know, dance or gymnastics or tightrope walking, you're not thinking about it. If you think about it, you fall over. So you're not witnessing it from your head, but your body is witnessing it. Your body is sensing in its own way that feels right, and it's able to synchronize. So That's why it's important to remember that the body is the mind, or the body has mind in it, and to really use that faculty, because then your sense of watchfulness can become much more free from positions, because the body works in terms of cohesion and synchronicity and balance. So you can sense there's clarity around what you're doing. It's not blurred, it's not confused, it's not impelled. There's clarity, and that itself is one of the signs of awareness. Thank you.
And it was like the head first got in the way.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize it to what you were saying.
Yeah, the default is the energy rushes up into the head. So, it often comes from the heart and it rushes up into the head. And you get this incredible spinning stuff of either thinking you know what the problem is, or explaining it, but actually it's the head's version of it. It's the head's way of trying to handle that, but it isn't capable of handling it, so often we feel overwhelmed. And so the head tries even harder, and it gets even more overwhelmed. One of that is you just kind of acknowledge that state. You can't ever find an answer from a place of overwhelm and panic. You never find any answer from that. The only answer you can find is just you've got to, sort of come into your body. Because if you come into your body, then your heart will start to get more sensible. The three work together. Because the mind doesn't settle because it doesn't have anywhere to settle. The head doesn't settle because it's got nowhere to settle. So it's trying to find an answer in its own thoughts. It's like a dog running around in a circle, trying to find a basket, trying to find its tail or somewhere to sit down in. It can't. How can it do that? But it can if you provide a basket. It will sit down. And the basket is the body. And you touch that, like often just coming into your hands or your feet. And a sense maybe of a breathing. It's that reference to that. It's like you can almost feel the effect of when you break the feedback loop of thought just by introducing a bodily experience as well. Suddenly it starts to unravel and you come into, what I really mean is, why does it do that? Why is it then when we're upset, one of the most helpful things is just somebody holds you, because that physical brings you back into your own body, particularly if it's mutual. There's a sense of grounding and you come out of this panic, which panic always cuts us off in a vacuum where the only thing that's going on is this whirlpool, and there's no way that whirlpool can find a way out of itself, because it isn't, you can't do that, you have to provide something else. Body is often the answer. Thank you. Gentleman over there.
You told a story about somebody inviting all the different religions in the world to come together and talk about differences, similarities, whatever. I think the age we're in now is discrimination by religion. How do you come to peace with that?
Well, I can't come to peace with it in Buddhism, because Buddhism's part of the problem. In that sense, isn't it? But you can, I mean, generally, you try to come to peace with it. It's like, hello, human, in there. You know, on a conceptual level, there's no, you're just endless, you know, debates, comparisons, which could be interesting if it's done in the spirit of humour and good friendship. But if you're trying to prove what's right and wrong, it's unpleasant. So, you know, the answer to right and wrong is, hello, human. How's things? Yeah, I guess they, you know, there has to be, I imagine, for all of us. Maybe I'm worried, therefore I won't drive my vehicle so far. I'll use less gas. That could be an answer that comes up, or I'll help out, I'll try and offer some assistance, or, you know, I'll talk to my congressman about it, or, you know, there could be a range of answers that come from that. But you've got to, that's the answer that each one has to find ourselves, don't we? You know, the answer comes from meeting. I can't say where for each one of us that meeting occurs and what happens. I can't say what the response will be, because then it wouldn't be, I would be, you know, speaking about response that has to be each individual's response.
Speak a little more about the, you were talking about mind not being able to be located, it just is happening. And sort of as about mind as an event. You know, I found myself for many weeks just completely on autopilot and feeling like my thoughts are like a head cold or something that's just happening to me. And then when I noticed them, I realized how entrenched they are in a pattern, and I was intrigued by that idea of mind as a verb rather than as a noun.
Yeah, it is a verb. It's verbal. Verbal. It's So there's the particular see, for example, consciousness is not, which tends to be a noun in our understanding of it, is really a verb. It's being conscious of. So being conscious of something through the eye, through the ear, through the nose, through the tongue, through thoughts, through the mind. So we tend to imagine it as some sort of immaterial entity. Yeah. And mind, the same thing, you know. So it's some kind of immaterial entity. But it's an ongoing process. That's why, you know, in Buddha Dharma you're not saying, you know, where is the enlightened mind? Or where is the sublime consciousness? The Buddha's talking about where does it stop? Where does the verb cool down? Where does it stop? Yeah. Not as an annihilationist. He said this is not an annihilationist doctrine. This is not nihilism. Saying that in the stopping of that particular energy, something else is experienced. Yeah.
There has to be that release of that energy.
Yeah, yeah.
Something else
will
just...
No, well, it releases, like, what happened to the fist? Where did I put it? Mm-hmm. What fist? What are you talking about? What happened to the... Where did it go? Did you put it somewhere? Did you... Mm-hmm. Where did you release it? I just... It's rather like that, you know. I mean, we call it a hand. So how did a fist change in, you know... Is it a fist or a hand? Or, you know, a palm or a finger or what. So, most of the time it's doing this. You know, it's tending to fisting, it's called grasping. You know? And there's an energy of that, the continual pulse of energy is called sankhara. Sankhara, which means forming or formations or formativeness. And that comes through, you know, through the body, through the thinking and through the heart. There's a continual kind of shaping things up into apparent experiences. Well, they are experiences, but they're apparent entities. So we have a thought and another thought and another thought. We have apparent entities. But actually, when you try to look at a thought, you can't find the real beginning of it. You can't find the end of it. Something that has no beginning and no end isn't much of an entity, is it? It's really just like it's a flow that sort of starts to come together and starts to fall apart. And it doesn't actually, you know, come in fully formed and end. It sort of it crystallizes and then evaporates because it's energetic. Yeah. So, you know, when we begin to sense that, you realize that to come to terms with that energy, then is a subtle education of attitude and relationship. We're not trying to get rid of it. We're not trying to make it into something, but we're learning to be cooler and more peaceful and more skillful in riding that energy. So first of all, it's going to a good place, you know? It's going to a good place, and then how does it actually just take a break? How does it just release itself? How does it find a way where it's not needed, you know, when it's settled? But that's not through cutting it out. It becomes very important when we're dealing with big things that we really want to cut out, like anger or greed or passion or something like that. You really want to get rid of this thing. And it's work to actually meet the energy, ride the energy, and give it a place to transmute. In other words, you can't cut it off. You can cut off the actions that come out of it, which is good. You can cut off the proliferations that can come out of it, which is necessary. But the energy itself is just like you've just got to get it to do that. And then, it's no longer a fist anymore. It's just, and it, anger becomes strength, you know, rather than, you know. And we need that energy. But you can't in that process. It's just all snarled up. So when we start to, you know, begin to understand these things, then, or at least you can at least get the idea. Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it. That makes sense to me. I've tried to stop it. I can't stop it. I can't get rid of it. Maybe I'll try another way. Just how do I sort of meet it as a feeling, as a sense running through my system, as I cut off the topics, just feel the energy of that. How do I accommodate that, soften it? How do I give it a place where it can rest? You know, where it can, and it's not off, for most that we get powerful energy, you can't crush it into a place. You have to widen it into a place. You know, then it, you know, it's like you can't expect the Columbia River to fit into a teapot, but it will fit into the ocean perfectly well.
I think that's all the time we have.
Right.